The 1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 351, Mormonism and the Idea of Progress, Some Late Night Thoughts While Listening to Bach's B Minor Mass, a paper by David H. Bailey, with comments by Richard Cummings. The chair is Christian Fonsbeck. This is a one-hour session recorded on a 90-minute tape, so the second half of Side 2 will be blank.
Good afternoon. They ask us to please start on time, and unaccustomed as I am to doing that, why, here we go. My name is Christian Fonsbeck. This is the session number 351, entitled Mormonism and the Idea of Progress, Some Late Night Thoughts While Listening to Bach's B Minor Mass. I'd like to thank those at Sunstone who have made this possible for us. I think we're extremely fortunate to have this available. And even though they make it look easy, I'm sure that that isn't always the case. We just have an hour, and our commenter Richard Cummings hasn't yet arrived, but he's got a little more time, so I'd like to keep the introductions brief because we don't have a lot of time. But there we go.
Sorry about that.
We're on. Okay. David Bailey is our presenter. Richard Cummings, our commenter. These are men who've both published in both Sunstone and Dialogue. Good friends of Sunstone. We're in good hands this afternoon. They both have doctorates from Stanford. Some similarities. But let me set the stage a little bit. David Bailey is a scientist with a doctorate in math, a computer scientist at Lawrence Berkeley Lab. You can visualize him listening to Bach. That's what mathematicians do, right? He's married with four daughters. And so that's an interesting facet. I venture to guess that their behavior isn't always logically predictable. Then we have Richard Cummings with a dual doctorate in French and humanities. He was the director of the university honors program for 25 years and is still active in the honors field. He's will give us a different facet of experience. He's currently retired and enjoying painting and poetry and traveling with his wife, Julie. So let's get underway. David Bailey with Mormonism and the Idea of Progress. Then we'll have comments from Richard Cummings and perhaps time for questions afterwards.
Actually, maybe we should change glasses here to... it's one of the things that happens when you approach middle age is, one thing is you start forgetting things. So... I hope with that introduction and this title, I hope we don't have a lot of musicians in the audience who may be disappointed with my presentation. But I am a self-confessed Bach fan, and I do listen to Bach a great deal. Johann Sebastian Bach Johann Sebastian Bach's Mass in B minor is, I think, considered to be one of the greatest creations in the classical repertoire. Although there have been some performances of this work in Mormon communities, like around here, but it is not nearly as well known among Mormons, say, as Handel's Messiah. Why Bach composed the B minor Mass is somewhat of a mystery. There is no evidence that he received a commission for this work, and since he himself was Lutheran, it could not be performed at his own church. Yet evidently he labored over it on and off for some 15 years, completing it in 1849, just before his death. Ironically, this work, along with all of the rest of Bach's compositions, languished and was almost lost to history until revived in the 19th century. The Mass itself was not performed in its entirety until 1835, which was some 85 years after Bach's death. The B minor Mass contains some of Bach's most inspiring and, I think, uplifting score. One of my personal favorite movements is Et Expecto, please excuse my poor pronunciation of Latin, which one musicologist describes as shattering the stillness of the adagio with the sudden outburst of a chorus of ecstatic joy. The text of this movement sums up the glorious message of the Christian gospel, which translated from Latin is, "And I look forward to the resurrection of the dead and the life of the world to come. Amen." It's hard for us in the 20th century to really fully appreciate the significance of this forward-looking aspect of Judeo-Christian religion in the history of world thought. Most other ancient religions believed in an endless cycle of recurrent cycles, or an endless course of recurrent cycles. For example, in Babylonian cosmology, a great year lasts 424,000 years, after which the universe repeats. Even Plato's cosmology was cyclic, with the periodic destruction and recreation of the world. The Jewish religion, in contrast, taught what is now termed as linear or progressive history. The world had a starting point in the past, progress has been achieved, and we can look forward to a glorious future epoch when the misfortunes, injustices, and evil of this world will be set right. This can be seen in the Old Testament account of the creation of the earth, in the promise to Abraham that his seed would prosper, in the account of Moses and the children of Israel migrating from Egypt to the promised land, in the longing of captive Judah to return, and finally in the anticipation of the Messiah, who, as was generally believed, would overthrow their oppressors and introduce a new era of glory and righteousness. Christianity further advanced this tradition of progressive history or linear history by identifying Christ as the Messiah who came in the meridian of time, by teaching a higher law that superseded the law of Moses, by predicting a future second coming of Christ who would usher in a reign of peace for a millennium, and then by describing a heaven where the righteous dead will ultimately be resurrected to eternal life with God. Closely connected with this concept of linear progressive history is the Judeo-Christian belief that God governs the universe as well as human society based on a system of rational laws. We may not fully understand all of these laws at this present time, but as we progress in faith and knowledge, eventually God's system of order will become clear. Faith in the rationality of God and his laws is emphasized in books such as Job, which eloquently teaches us to cling to the faith that ultimately everything will be righted, in spite of the many tragedies and hardships in life that could lead one to doubt God. This expectation of a progressively brighter and more rational future has had impact far beyond the world of religion. British philosopher Alfred North Whitehead noted that modern science, as it developed in the West, was based on, quote, "the inexpugnable belief that every detailed occurrence can be correlated with its antecedents in a perfectly definite manner, exemplifying general principles. Without this belief, the incredible labors of the scientists would be without hope." Elsewhere, Whitehead explained the origin of this deeper faith that was so crucial to the progress of European science. He said, "When we compare this tone of thought in Europe with the attitude of other civilizations when left to themselves, there seems but one source for its origin. It must come from the medieval insistence on the rationality of God." The overarching idea described above has often been termed the idea of progress. 20th century author Robert Nisbet defines the idea of progress as the notion that mankind has advanced in the past from barbarism and ignorance, is now advancing, and will continue to advance through the foreseeable future. It is arguably the central driving engine of thought that has led men throughout history to forge ahead. It is the foundation for those, even in our era, who look forward to a brighter future. Faith in human progress certainly sustained scientists such as Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, and Newton, even though their system of physics was at odds with the cosmology assumed in the Bible and taught since antiquity. They recognized that it constituted a more rational framework for the modern world. The Catholic Church resisted these developments for many years, but eventually acknowledged them as part of the great Christian tradition of progress. 17th and 18th century Protestant writers such as Calvin embraced this idea of progress. Even in the early 20th century, French philosopher Pierre Desjardin argued that human progress was inexorable, virtually mandated by the laws of the universe. He further saw an idea that the idea of progress as a theme that could unify science and religion. And I personally think that this is a very important idea that isn't really appreciated much today. But by the middle of the 20th century, progressives such as Desjardins were a minority voice. Even in the 19th century, German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche revived this doctrine of eternal recurrence, and he disparaged the notion of progress. Quote, "Mankind does not represent a development towards something better or stronger or higher in any sense. Progress is a modern idea, that is, a false idea." In commenting on Nietzsche's writings, Kaufman noted that the doctrine of eternal recurrence is the antithesis of any faith in infinite progress, whether it be evolution, Faust's unbounded striving, or endless improvement of the human soul. It is the antithesis, too, of any faith in another world. Tragically, the Nazi movement adopted many of Nietzsche's notions, including his belief in an eternal recurrence and in his denial of progress. The swastika is an ancient symbol for eternal recurrence. In the past few decades, it has become fashionable in academic circles to minimize or even deny the notion of human progress. This is perhaps a reaction to this century's grim legacy of two devastating world wars, not to mention the horrors of Hitler's Holocaust, Stalin's prison camps, Mao's Cultural Revolution, and Pol Pot's killing fields, among other things. It also may be due to a growing consciousness of our legacy of African slavery, the conquest of Native American peoples, and the oppression of women. Such tragedies have led some thinkers to question the notion of human progress, as well as the concept of linear history. Indeed, the postmodern movement of recent years can be seen as questioning some of the traditional claims of human progress. Even in the realm of science, where one would think that progress is indisputable, there have been detractors. As astronomer Timothy Ferris notes, "The empirical spirit on which the Western democratic societies were founded is currently under attack, and not just by traditional adversaries such as religious fundamentalists and devotees of the occult. Serious scholars claim that there is no such thing as progress and assert that science is but a collection of opinions, as socially conditioned as the weather vane world of Paris couture." So, Mormonism, from its founding, has upheld the fundamental notions of the progressive theme in Judeo-Christian thought. But Mormonism went beyond traditional Christianity regard. A central tenet of Mormonism is modern revelation, which affirms that progress in religious knowledge has not stopped, but continues forward, just as in the secular world. This is most clearly stated in our ninth article of faith. We believe in all that God has revealed, all that does now reveal, and we believe that he will yet reveal many great and important things pertaining to the kingdom of God. When I first was reading some of this literature on the idea of progress, I was really struck by the similarity between the ninth article of faith and what is taken, say, as the definition of the idea of progress by scholar Robert Nisbet, which is that mankind has advanced in the past, is now advancing, and will continue to advance through the foreseeable future. Along this line, early Mormonism's approach to Scripture was highly progressive. The Bible was accepted as the Word of God, but with significant limitations. The Book of Mormon and other new scriptures were brought forth as evidence that the heavens are not closed, but that revelation continues to progress forward. Another of Mormonism's doctrinal innovations was the law of eternal progression, namely that mortal life is an interlude between a preparatory premortal existence and a eternal postmortal existence, where the righteous will continue to advance in knowledge and glory without limit. Along this line, the DNC teaches us that whatever principle of intelligence we attain to in this life, it will rise with us in the resurrection. Furthermore, in a departure from traditional Christian orthodoxy, Joseph Smith taught that God works in accord with natural laws, rather than by transcending them or setting them aside. Thus, progress achieved in secular and scientific world, rather than detracting from our faith, can actually affirm faith and bolster one's knowledge of God. The migration of the saints to Utah was carried out in obvious analog to the migration of the Hebrews to Israel, and their establishment of a kingdom of God in the Great Basin was driven by their unwavering faith to achieve a modern Zion. Mormonism's progressive theology was preached throughout the 19th century. Brigham Young asserted that the first great principle, the mainspring of all action, is the principle of improvement. Brigham Young went further than Joseph Smith in embracing progress in the secular world. He also espoused a progressive doctrine of God, dismissing the sectarian notion of an absolutely omniscient, unchanging being who does not progress in knowledge. In the 20th century, James E. Talmadge elaborated on the law of eternal progression. In the first edition of his book, The Articles of Faith, he went so far as to assert that human progression was possible after death, not only within one kingdom of glory, but even between kingdoms. John A. Widtsoe was intrigued by Herbert Spencer's theory of progress, which he equated with Joseph Smith's doctrine of eternal progression. Widtsoe also taught that God was the organizer and not the creator of the world, and that he himself is governed by fundamental natural law. B.H. Roberts declared that the world's best hope is continued progress in the knowledge of the truth, and he argued that the restoration was the root of much of the human progress achieved in the 19th and early 20th century. Roberts also noted that Mormonism's progressive theology of God avoids many of the pitfalls of traditional Christian theology. B.H. Roberts was also an eloquent advocate for a progressive approach to science and religion. With regards to issues surrounding the creation, he wrote, "On the other hand, to limit and insist upon the whole of life and death to this side of Adam's advent on the earth, some 6,000 or 8,000 years ago, as proposed by some, is to fly in the face of facts so indisputably brought to light by the researcher of science in modern times. To pay attention and to give reasonable credence to their research is to link the Church of God with the highest increase of modern thought and effort. On that side lies development, on the other lies contraction. It is on the former side that research work is going on and will continue to go on. Future investigation and discoveries will continue on that side. Nothing will retard them, and nothing will develop on the other side. One leads to narrow sectarianism, the other keeps the open spirit of a world movement with which our new dispensation began. As between them, which is to be our choice? In more recent decades, some LDS authorities have continued to advocate a progressive approach to modern secular scholarship and to affirm progress in the greater society. Among these was President Hugh B. Brown, who wrote that we should all be interested in academic research. We must go out on the research front and continue to explore the vast unknown. We should be in the forefront of learning in all fields, for revelation does not come only through the prophet of God, nor only directly from heaven in visions and dreams. Revelation may come in the laboratory, out of the test tube, out of the thinking mind and the inquiring soul, out of search and research and prayer and inspiration. But as in the secular world at large, there appears to have been a retreat from the idea of progress in LDS thought during the second half of this century. One figure here is Joseph Fielding Smith, who staked out numerous doctrinal positions that were in opposition to modern secular and scientific thinking. For example, on scientific issues, he declared that the theory of evolution is falsehood absolutely, that the temporal age of the earth is a mere 7,000 years, and that Noah's flood literally immersed the entire globe in water. Bruce R. McConkie adopted many of these views in his influential work, Mormon Doctrine. In a 1980 speech at BYU, McConkie decried as heresies several doctrinal viewpoints that we would consider to be progressive, including the notion that God advances in knowledge, the theory of organic evolution, and the possibility of progression between kingdoms in the afterlife. President David O. McKay, in spite of his generally progressive doctrinal views, he was among the first to start voicing concern that mankind's spiritual progress is lagging. He noted growing cost of crime and criticized increasing sexual permissiveness, which he warned could destroy society. He associated these trends with an increasing irrelevance of religion in daily life, a consequence of a widespread decline in church attendance and a collapse of moral standards. Other general authorities began to echo similar statements, among them Alvin R. Dyer and Mark E. Peterson. Ezra Taft Benson linked this erosion of morality to economic decline in the U.S. particularly, together with concerns that the U.S. and other Western nations were drifting towards socialism and communism. He mentioned cheating in schools, juvenile delinquency, pornography, drugs and crime, and then tied these to increases in U.S. federal budget deficits and the welfare state and inflation. Howard W. Hunter, perhaps as openly as any of the general authorities, openly questioned whether spiraling progress in technology and in secular knowledge was good for society. And he raised further concerns about moral decline. The highly literal approach to the scriptures advocated by Joseph Fielding Smith and Bruce R. McConkie has carried over to the present day. Typical of the philosophy of this philosophy are the recent declarations of a BYU religion scholar who declared, "We take the scriptures to be literally true. We hold symbolic, figurative, or allegorical interpretations to a minimum, accepting the miraculous events as historical and the moral and ethical teachings as binding and valid." And in another place, he said, "There isn't a single verse of the Bible that I do not personally accept and believe." This is clearly in the same spirit as a recent statement by various Christian evangelical groups affirming the absolute inerrancy of the Bible. Recent years have also seen a continuing reluctance to accept progress in various fields of scientific research. There are some indication of a softening of the Church's official views in this area, but relatively few Mormons are even aware of these official stances, and fundamentalist rhetoric abounds. The humanities and arts have not fared much better. In 1992, BYU administration disapproved the selection of Mormon Pulitzer Prize-winning author Laurel Thatcher Ulrich as a keynote speaker for the 1993 BYU Women's Conference. In the past several years, BYU has terminated or pressured to resign a number of scholars from its faculty. The school recently banned the display of some Rodin sculptures and nixed a screening of Schindler's List. Furthermore, the church has declared in its church music handbook that much of the classical music repertoire is inappropriate for sacrament meetings. The church has also been reluctant to support modern social movements. This can be seen in the church's mixed response to the civil rights movement in the 60s and their opposition to the proposed ERA amendment in the late 70s and in the current efforts to defeat various measures granting rights to homosexual couples. The church's president concerns in this area were illustrated in a speech by Boyd K. Packer in 93, who identified three threats to the modern church, namely the gay lesbian movement, the feminist movement, and the challenge from scholars and intellectuals. A recently published book by Joseph Fielding McConkie is perhaps most illuminating with regards to subtle shifts away from this generally pro-progress philosophy and theology that characterized the thinking in the church in earlier years. And I understand that this present time this book is selling very strongly in LDS bookstores. Here are some excerpts. God is not subservient to the laws of the physical universe. The laws that govern in the celestial realm are far beyond those known to us in this temporal, telestial state. Question. Is the doctrine of evolution compatible, or is the theory of evolution compatible with the doctrine of the fall? Answer, no. We can tug, twist, contort, and sell our birthright, but we cannot overcome the irreconcilable differences between the theory of organic evolution and the doctrine of the fall. Evolution is the notion that lower forms of life can, through the course of generations, genetically improve themselves. For that to happen, both birth and death would have to exist. The world will know 7,000 years of temporal history. To argue for a longer time is to suggest ages for which God has forgotten to call for accountability. Question, did God discover law or is he the author of it? Answer, God is the author of law, not its creation or its servant. God is not a scientist. He does not harness law and then use it to bless and govern his creation. Question, is a mastery of the laws of mathematics and science necessary to the process of obtaining exaltation? Answer, if they are, we are yet to receive the revelation that tells us so. He quotes several of the scriptures that refer to learning and how it will advance with us. But then he says, properly understood, such texts center our attention on things of the spirit rather than the intellect. It is not the learning of the classroom to which these passages of Scripture refer, but rather to those things that can only be learned in the service. Question, does the gospel embrace all truth? Answer, no. Innumerable truths have no bearing on that sacred body of truth we call the gospel. Similarly, any principle that does not require the Spirit of the Lord to be taught, it can be taught as well by a faithless man as a learned, as well by students of faith as by those who are making no effort to accord their lives with the standards the Lord has set. Such a truth is not a principle of the gospel and will be of no value in the world to come. I think we'll all agree that such positions are clearly at odds with some of these progressive views of earlier LDS leaders. Yet given the popularity of this book, it is clear that many, if not the majority, of LDS leaders and individual members today are comfortable with these views. So, tilting against the tide of human progress is a dangerous thing to do, since progress generally triumphs over decline. In this regard, it's interesting to note some of the current news developments. One, there's been a dramatic decline in crime during the last few years. Two, after increasing for many years, rates of teenage sex and pregnancy have leveled off and even declined somewhat. While several factors are at work here, one key reason is that young people are brimming with ambition due to an improving outlook for the future. Three, abortions are declining and attitudes towards casual abortion are becoming less permissive. Four, the U.S. unemployment rate right now is at a 25-year low and the rate of inflation is virtually zero. U.S. per capita incomes, even after adjustment for inflation, are steadily increasing. Five, the U.S. budget deficit, which recently as a few years ago seemed to be careening out of control and which has prompted numerous expressions of concern from LDS authorities, has plunged to zero, partly as a result of an improving economy. Six, the concern widely voiced in the 1980s that the U.S. has squandered its position of world leadership in a number of key arenas, due in part to moral weakness, is not heard much anymore. Contrary to the popular perception of widespread environmental decline, substantial progress has been achieved on many fronts during recent years. For example, in Los Angeles area, 1997 was the cleanest year on record. Certainly there are many other areas of concern, such as the destruction of tropical rainforests. But I personally am encouraged that decades of education appear to be paying off, as people worldwide are now more aware of environmental issues and more willing to accept sacrifice for a cleaner environment. Eight, the prohibition of alcohol and tobacco, which was once the exclusive and backward progress of Latter-day Saints, is now virtually mainstream. In California, where I live, smoking is now prohibited in virtually all public places, including bars and restaurants. Many states have stepped up enforcement of drunk driving laws, and new limits on alcohol beverage and advertising are being considered. Nine, life expectancy continues to increase. Scientists have recently announced some promising breakthroughs in the treatment of cancer and perhaps have discovered what may be an agent that will retard aging. Number 10, racism has greatly declined in recent years, at least in the U.S., and women enjoy greater protection both at home and at work. There is greater awareness of child abuse. Now, it's not to say that there aren't serious problems in this area remaining, but I don't think we can deny that significant progress has been made. In spite of stagnant government support for basic scientific research, there have been remarkable numbers of amazing scientific discoveries have been announced in recent years. A wave of new information technologies has come to blesses people around the world with unprecedented access to educational materials, not to mention great works of art and literature. Also of significance is the degree to which these modern information technologies inhibit the misdeeds of tyrants. This is seemingly in fulfillment of LDS scriptures, which promise in the last days their iniquity shall be spoken upon housetops and their secret acts shall be revealed. Number 13, with the end of Cold War and the collapse of the Soviet Union, the threat of worldwide nuclear war has been greatly reduced. And I think that there's even been a fundamental change towards war, where people worldwide are recognizing that war is just not an acceptable way to settle differences. finally, perhaps most relevant to what we're talking about here, there is, of course, a widespread popular perception that church attendance and religiosity have significantly declined in this century. Indeed, the sentiment has been echoed on numerous occasions by numerous general authorities. But a recent study indicates that, according to several specific measures, religious belief has not declined in recent years, but in fact is nearly indistinguishable from 50 or 100 years ago. In fact, there are some indications of a renaissance in religious belief at the present time. A related study of American research scientists produced a similar result. The percentage of scientists who believe in God today is not significantly different than in 1916. I might mention that with regards to several of the above items, that I perhaps should apologize for some of these, since they clearly reflect a U.S. perspective. Clearly things are not as rosy in Africa or Asia or the former Soviet Union at the present time. But certainly basic civil rights are unavailable to many around the world, and many more remain mired in poverty and ignorance. But I don't think we can deny that there is a significant turnaround in our long-term outlook. Declinism and negativism have run their course. The idea of progress is alive and well. So, where should the church stand today on questions such as this? Should it embrace or downplay the wave of human progress? Should it celebrate or disparage artistic expressions and the general acquisition of human knowledge? Should it emphasize the positive developments or emphasize the negative? Clearly, there are no easy answers here. Certainly, it would be just as wrong for the church to embrace every trendy fad as it would be to pretend that nothing of good report ever comes forth from society. Charting the course of the church through the shoals of modernity has never been an easy task, and it will not be any easier in the future. It clearly will require prayerful consideration on the part of many in the church, both leaders and individual members. To that end, though, I would like to offer the following thoughts, recognizing that some may see things differently. Number one, if the church avoids or downplays the artistic, musical, and scholarly wealth of our civilization, it may miss out on some of the most exalted expressions of the human spirit. Two, if the church emphasizes negative developments of society and always downplays positive developments, its message may be increasingly questioned in an era when progress is evident on many fronts. Three, if the church insulates itself from society, either individually or at large, both the church and society will suffer. Four, if the church denies or minimizes human progress, ironically, it may be endorsing some of the key views of the postmodern movement, which is not really very supportive of traditional authority structures such as the church. Five, if the church turns away from its traditional concept of a progressing, coexistent God and teaches, like other Christian churches, that God is wholly beyond our comprehension, omnipotent and omniscient, then the church may lose much of its distinctiveness, much of the distinctiveness of its theology, and it would become subject to many of the difficulties that have ensnared traditional Christian theology. Six, if the church turns away from its traditional concept of a God who works within the realm of natural law, it may lose its unique doctrinal foundation for finding harmony between science and religion. Do we believe in a capricious magician who has placed evidence throughout the universe to mislead diligent seekers of truth? Or do we believe in an intelligent, rational being who is pleased when we discover the elegant laws that govern the universe? Seven, if the church teaches or endorses doctrinal views that are at odds with well-established principles of modern secular or scientific scholarships, It will place many of its members, especially its college-age youth, in severe conflict with the intellectual world. 8. If the church dismisses modern biblical scholarship, it may miss some important insights into the deeper spiritual meanings, and it may needlessly cling to questionable notions that should be discarded. 9. If the church teaches that much of what we learn on this earth is not relevant to our existence after death, its teachings may appear to be of questionable relevance to people here now who are seeking solutions to the many challenges of daily life. If the church downplays the possibility of progress in the world to come, it may lead some who have faltered for one reason or another to lose hope. 11. If the church is perceived as frequently adopting stances in opposition to relatively benign social movements, it may alienate significant segments of its own membership, and it may lose potential converts as well. And finally, if the church teaches that its leaders, past or present, individually or collectively, are infallible, i.e. that they cannot lead the church astray, then it may be very difficult for the church to make major changes when the need arises. Infallibility is antithetical to progress. Thank you.
When I was first approached about responding to David Bailey's paper, I was intrigued by the title, which juxtaposed three seemingly disparate elements, namely Mormonism, progress, and Johann Sebastian Bach. I was already familiar with two fine articles by David Bailey, which had appeared in Dialogue. The first was his prize-winning piece entitled Scientific Foundations of Mormon Theology, which came out in the summer of 1988. And the second, appearing just 2 years ago, was his Science and Mormonism, Past, Present, and Future, both of which make an eloquent case for a closer alignment between Mormonism and the methods and discoveries of science. Consequently, I expected his latest reflections to be both engaging and enlightening. And to say the least, I have not been disappointed. I had hoped David had found some intriguing link between Bach and Mormonism, but it became clear that the only correlation was that the genius of Bach was contagious and inspired some serious late-night thinking. I think that's great. I would like to say one other thing, and that is that it's actually a delight to respond to anything that David does, because he is indeed a computer science expert. And I've received, I think, about four different versions of the paper, beautifully formatted on email. He's able to convey those so that I just pull them up, and there it is, footnoted and everything else. And by the way, you're getting cheated. You're getting the shorter version, which is necessary because of the time frame in which it has to be fitted. And he's done a beautiful job with this. All right. Because I'm in basic agreement with David's position, I'll limit my own remarks to a minor adjustment to his views and a few related observations of my own. First, the paper seems to imply that a progressive spirit predominated in Mormon circles throughout most of the 19th century and on into the 20th century, until increasingly conservative views came to the fore beginning in the 70s and continuing up to the present time. For the record, however, I would like to point out that Mormonism has included a wide assortment of beliefs and concepts, ranging from the remarkably progressive definition of human nature based on an autonomous core intelligence with unlimited divine potential, to such regressive throwbacks to Old Testament culture as the long discredited practice of polygamy and the barbarities of blood atonement. Those things have been there for a long time. Depending on the priorities and preferences of the power elite at any given moment, we end up with what can look at times like the flavor of the month, or at least of the decade, in theological and ecclesiastical policies. Second, I agree with David that the more progressive voices seemed to predominate during much of the time, including even that of Brigham Young, when he was not expounding the Adam-God doctrine or exercising tyrannical control over his domain.
It seems to me that this science-friendly, intellectually oriented, progressive spirit, beginning with the ascendancy of Joseph Fielding Smith and of his close ally and successor, Harold B. Lee, a much more defensive attitude towards science and the life of the mind has taken hold of the church. It's almost as though people just don't trust the church to be able to defend itself the way that earlier thinkers felt that it could. One sees the gospel and indeed the very fabric of Mormon belief as somehow vulnerable to scientific or serious intellectual inquiry. Now, in view of David's allusion to the pervasive influence of Joseph Fielding Smith's son-in-law and fellow general authority, Bruce R. McConkie, I cannot resist quoting briefly from an excerpt from President David O. McKay's January 7, 1960 daybook entry, which is currently circulating on the Internet. And I quote, "The first presidency met with elders Mark E. Peterson and Marion G. Romney. They submitted their report upon their examination of the book Mormon Doctrine by Elder Bruce McConkie. These brethren reported that the manuscript of the book Mormon Doctrine had not been read by the reading committee. Elder Peterson stated that the extent of the corrections which he had marked in his copy of the book, 1067, affected most of the 776 pages of the book. It was agreed that the necessary corrections are so numerous that to republish a corrected edition of the book would be such an extensive repudiation of the original as to destroy the credit of the author, that the republication of the book should be forbidden, and that the book should be repudiated in such a way as to save the career of the author as one of the general authorities of the church," close quote. There's much more, but I'm going to leave it at that. It is interesting to note that Mormon doctrine was indeed removed from circulation until Elder McConkie's father-in-law became president of the church, when suddenly a new, slightly revised edition appeared and has been widely distributed ever since. Finally, I would like to commend our speaker for courageously summarizing his concerns in the form of 12 thoughts, which might be construed by some as an exercise in instructing the brethren. In reality, all he has done is to list in a perfectly straightforward manner what must be the negative consequences of adhering too closely to the oft-repeated admonition to follow the brethren. His 12 ifs are a timely reminder of where misguided authoritarianism can lead. It could be argued that the brethren are following each other so closely that they have lost track of the tenor of the times, and that their narrow focus keeps them from seeing the bigger picture afforded by scientific inquiry and progressive thought. Thank you.
Thank you. That was great. We have a few minutes now for questions and comments. And if you have listened to the tapes, if you haven't, you need to buy some tapes and do that. But if you have, you'll know how difficult it is when you come to the part of the tape where someone comments from the audience and you can't hear that. So if you wouldn't mind, come up and use the microphone. Let's keep it all on the tape. Fred?
I wonder, David, if you had any thoughts about the Roslin experiments and cloning in terms of their implications for Mormon theology, and whether or not the brethren or the church has had any response to that tremendous leap in scientific capacity.
Actually, I've heard that isn't there in the recent Sunstone an article about Dwayne, can you come and comment on that?
Oh, Courtney Campbell in the lab.
Why don't you come up here? Sure. Yeah.
in the last issue of Sunstone, Courtney Campbell, who's the philosopher, relates his experience in being asked by the church to gather information for them as to how other religious groups were dealing with cloning, and hoping to gain some sort of insight from a study committee or person or whoever was designated to do that as to what approach the church should take. And then his great disappointment at the two-sentence statement that ultimately was produced, which in his, if I read the lines correctly, in his attitude or his estimate, said virtually nothing. It was a statement that the usual way, or the, you know, the way of making children is divinely approved. That is normal sex, I assume. Was not developed further. So Campbell expressed some great disappointment that all this effort had been done and then nothing much came from it.
I just wanted to ask if you have a website of your own where you posted some of your other writings, and if so, would you mind giving out your URL?
My email address is baileydh@pacbell.net.
I'll just make one comment. I don't have so much a question as an expression of embarrassment. I mean, here the Pope of the Catholic Church has said that the theory of evolution is more than a theory, and the Catholic Church, who we've always thought of as our arch-conservative enemy, is progressing ahead of us. I find that embarrassing.
Dave, maybe you could explore the thought that perhaps the reason why there's a difference between the 18th century or 19th century church and the 20th century church has to do with the relationship of the membership as in general to the leadership, whereas in the former times they were largely agrarian-oriented people. They were not as educated as they are today, so they looked to the leadership for progressive thought and ways of extending their life into the future, whereas nowadays they're old men. The general membership of the church is significantly more educated in the ways of progress and so on, and perhaps that conflict may be occurring as a result of that juxtaposition.
Well, others have expressed concern that, you know, you might say the increasing age distribution of the general authorities in subtle ways makes it them less willing to, you know, really do adopt more progressive views. But again, I don't know that anyone has done any serious study or analysis there. Is anyone else? Would you like to have a help?
I think I would agree with you that clearly there is a problem. We have aging authorities at the present time, and there were very young men at the beginning of the church, and I'm sure that makes a difference. But the point I made, I think I would like to make again, and that is, for whatever reason, I think since the time of Joseph Fielding Smith, there has been a tendency to be very, very chary about anything that seemed to challenge what was taken to be the conventional belief. And so this extremely defensive attitude has developed. I was going to tell an interesting story. I was actually very well acquainted with John A. Widsoe. His grandson was a very close friend of mine, and I was a familiar in his home. And at the time that he and Joseph Fielding Smith were both apostles in the church, Joseph Fielding really resented John A. Woodsell because he actually had come up the line as a result of educational achievements. He had a degree from Harvard. He had a Ph.D. degree from the University of Göttingen. He was an outstanding chemist and all those things. And, of course, Joseph Fielding Smith had not even gone to college and really became an apostle primarily because his father was president of the church. So there was a kind of resentment there, and on one occasion, Richard L. Evans happened into the office of Joseph Fielding Smith. He was, I think, just trying to check something out. He was, of course, on close terms with John A. Woodsell, and he noticed John A. Woodsell's latest book on the desk where Joseph Fielding had been working, obviously, and he'd been using a big red pencil, and he had marked all kinds of things, and what he'd marked particularly in the margins were false doctrine, false doctrine. And that simply underlined this basic opposition between the two different mentalities. It's like a very verbal divide.
I'd like to add just one little anecdote to this. Some of you may be familiar with a pamphlet, a very interesting pamphlet written by James E. Talmage called The Earth and Man. It was actually published by the church. 1931. Very good. I see. Wow. And in it, he gives what he is trying to, as a reasonable approach to these issues of geology and paleontology. And he says, among other things, that he mentions how that we have large layers of chalk deposits and how that these were organisms that lived and died generation after generation long before the time of Adam. And he also, I remember a comment in there of emphasizing how that the opening chapters of Genesis and the other creation scriptures were never intended to be a textbook of geology or theology. And in fact, we don't do the scriptures reverence when we misinterpret them by faulty assumptions such as this. And anyway, the... maybe you can help me out, Duane, but as I understand that there was a copy of this pamphlet that was in Joseph Fielding Smith's office and was later part of some papers donated to BYU. And written on the front of this pamphlet in Joseph Fielding Smith's handwriting was false doctrine.
My father was T.F. Lyon, and I remember him. He and old Benny were called down to Joseph Fielding Smith. This is Joseph P. Fielding Smith anecdote day. I'm Lawrence Lyon. I'm a composer, writer in the church, and they were called down and roundly scolded because of their teachings at the Institute of Religion with regard to answering students' honest questions. Now, what you have to understand, and again, there's an honest answer, evolution doesn't cover everything. We think it's evolution or error, but it really doesn't. Evolution makes a lot of mistakes and a lot of other kinds of things, so it isn't a choice to me of one or the other, but they were roundly scolded, and Roald Benyon and her dad, I think, called President McKay and said, "What about this?" And President McKay as much as said, "You have to kind of live with this," and gave them a talk about evolution, about the age of the Earth, as being quite different from this, and essentially said, "That's one opinion." The problem is people expressing individual opinions, as I learned this in the hall. General authorities having individual, strong individual opinions, and Joseph Fielding Smith did. And I have a very liberal church member friend who expected the church just to go to pieces when Joseph Fielding Smith became president. And in fact, with Harold B. Lee's and other guidance, it was one of the most progressive years I remember. But I learned from this experience that there are differing opinions from the brethren, and if you can get to the highest source, probably I would listen to that particular source or whatever, because President McKay talked about the age of the earth as he understood it and was very sympathetic, and she said, "You go right on teaching what you're teaching because you're making an important difference in the lives of people who come to you with honest questions." I think that's legitimate. I have a second part to this, and that is in the area of the arts, and that is I don't think the arts can really be held accountable in the era of progress. Is Mozart better than Bach because he came later? Is Beethoven better than Mozart because he came later? Were there better techniques? And no, that's not the case. It's simply the matter that, whether they say with Beethoven,
music just got different. In the arts, it's not a matter of getting better. The 20th century composers are not writing better, or they're just writing different kinds of things. And from my standpoint, for a variety of reasons, we're a real renaissance in church music. There's a lot of junk out there, and it's sold by Deseret Book and others, too. But this has always been the case. The problem is, in Mozart and Beethoven's days, we didn't have recordings to record this stuff. So people still have to be discriminating. But every time the church has sponsored some kind of a thing where it looked official, church, they got burned, or somebody lost their testimony because the church changed in some way the use of that particular art form. So in some ways, they went on to hire, is it Harry Anderson for all these pictures that we see all around, a bit on the kids' side, because we do them and all up and down and whatever. But his testimony was not at stake when they did that. And so there's some other issues regarding testimony and feeling. Personally, I have felt no restrictions as an artist in the church as we make our own way, because I don't think the Lord expects us to watch the general authorities for guidance on what we should be doing with our lives. Thank you.
We got another minute or so. Other questions?
Well, our challenge is to go back to those Sunday school classes and keep making a difference, I guess. Okay, that's the close of our session. We'd like to really thank our presenters. Let's give them a big hand.